This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hello, and with me, Cam Ruslan, today we have the return of filmmaker, actor, writer, Na'a Murad.
Hi, hi again.
Hello. And we have a first-timer, but she is BFM's very own, Shamila Ganesan, who is also the producer and presenter of Front Row.
Well, thank you for having me, Cam.
I've been trying to have you for some time on the show.
Well, so it's great to have you. Glad I could make it finally.
And good, bigger good. Picture. Right?
Front row, which sits in bigger picture.
Oh, okay. The front row of the bigger picture.
Front row, no, the front row in front of the bigger picture. Something like that. And our three topics this week are, topic number one is, do men and women see fundamentally different things in films and books, etc.? Topic number two, second sleep. And topic number three is dress and culture.
Yeah, sums it up.
Yeah. So with the first topic, I was thinking that I think the greatest movie ever made is, I was going to say The Parent Trap, but no, Lawrence of Arabia.
Which all your listeners know by now.
Right.
Like David Bowie, Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay. And I first saw it when I was about 16. It just blew me away. But then I watched it like five times before it dawned on me, there are absolutely no women in that movie. Didn't cross my mind for a second.
Mm.
And now when I talk to my wife and I tell her there's a really great film, she'll always ask me, is there a woman in it? And I was like, I don't know. maybe. Why? And when we're watching a movie, she might just say in the middle of it, like, oh, that's a nice dress. And I'm thinking, well, I didn't even notice that this person was wearing a dress. When I quiz her on it more, it's not that she's saying it's just pretty in and of itself, but that the filmmakers have made the effort to have that character wear a dress that character should be wearing, and not instead in the standard thing, which is short skirt, high heels. Because if that character was wearing short skirt and high heels, which is what the director would probably, who is a man, would choose because that looks sexy, it's like, you just don't know who is that person. Why and why does that person exist?
That person is not a real person.
Yeah.
At least not a real woman, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's fundamentally why when people are making calls for diversity of filmmakers or diversity of writers, it's not just to make a, you know, needlessly feminist slant on everything. It's actually to improve the field as a whole, because the more people you have who are able to flesh out these things, what would a woman wear in this situation? If I were a female superhero, would I actually want to wear stilettos, or would I want to wear something practical that I can still kick?
Something so tight that you probably won't be able to
move
it.
Right,
exactly. Or some sort of armor on your shoulders.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And I think that's something that when Wonder Woman came out, for instance, a lot of people gave props for, was that their uniforms were both, interesting, powerful, made them look great, but was also functional. Mm. And that's not something that could have been done, I think, without having women in the crew, women behind the camera, as well as in front of the camera.
Yeah, but also the signaling then of the intent of the story, of the subtext, because so many, I mean, films are made by men. It's like 99%.
Yeah.
I take it on, I'm watching it, and it just all makes sense to me. But is it just not making sense to 50% of the world?
Not to say it doesn't make sense, but I think details are important. And I think also, I think sometimes the storytelling might be skewed to a certain sensibility. My ex-wife had a different thing. I don't know if it fits with what you're saying, but she didn't like it. She would always ask me if I had seen the film first, does it have a happy ending? You know, is there a lot of suffering?
Mm.
Because I think the difference, fundamental difference between me and her, this could be a filmmaker, a non-filmmaker kind of difference between that, because she took any kind of suffering, anything that was seen as an unhappy ending or an injustice, as being too real. She couldn't separate it. Whereas for me, it was a movie. You know, sure, a horrible ending, but it teaches you something. But there are people who emotionally just say, like, look, if it's about something unhappy, negative, I do not want to watch it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's a female trait or something,
well,
but it could
I
be just a personal
thing. I do
think,
though, it's how that suffering is framed, because one of the things that has become quite clearly identified in a lot of films made by men about women, or books written by men about women, tends to be that the woman is there to serve a specific role. Generally, it tends to be one of a sexual role, a lot of times it's a role of suffering. Women are put there to go through, you know, trouble.
To be the victim.
To be the victim.
Then the hero comes in.
Then the hero comes and saves them. So perhaps that's you know, I don't want to speak for your ex-wife, but then maybe that's part of the reason why this sort of suffering doesn't appeal to, like Cam said, 50% of the audience.
But I think she was quite general in that. Because she couldn't stand the fact that Robert Redford dies at the end of Great Gatsby.
Spoiler alert. But then speaking of storytelling, there's this movie where something really struck me once. Back in the 90s, I watched it, and it came in the early 90s, Orlando. From
Tilda Swinton.
Tilda Swinton, directed by Sally Potter.
Right.
And it's from the Virginia Woolf book. It was a movie which I was not in the mood to go watch it. And it was a woman director, and I thought, And then I watched it, and it blew me away. It was fantastic. Yeah. And one of the things, I'm not sure if I was overly aware of a woman director, I don't know. But that movie and the handful of other perhaps movies that I've watched directed by women, very different storytelling pacing, in that most movies, male movies, there's this this explosion at the end, whereas with the female movies, and I will bring in Parent Trap into this, is there are epiphanies along the way, emotional high points where it's really moving along the way, whereas most movies just one big thing at the end.
Yeah, I think female directors. I'm going to specifically talk about Kathryn Bigelow. She does films that the kind of films that men would direct. But if you are seeing an explosion at the end, somebody like Kathryn Bigelow, the explosion starts at the beginning and it finishes. It's like this slow explosion. And I think a lot of male filmmakers would not see certain possible moments to play on. Whereas I watched like a movie like Hurt Locker, it felt like it could have been directed by a man, but there were just certain things which you didn't expect that element of that character to actually be highlighted at that moment, and it was so effective.
Am I allowed to say that all of this imagery is actually sounding very Freudian?
Yes.
Really? Yeah, explosions.
Yeah. Well, the delayed gratification versus payoff at the end versus, I mean, it's... I think
you have a dirty mind.
I didn't notice at all.
But I think in a way, though, it's also how boys and girls are socialized to deal with just life in general. It's how women are often thought to be patient, to work for something, and then eventually you'll get what you want. And boys are thought that everything is working towards a goal. And perhaps that's kind of some of what's coming out in these texts that you're talking about.
But also, Ken was talking about his wife would notice a practical thing, like, for example, the costume. It's probably a more female thing to, you're trained to just see the details. Guys just rush through it. Let's get this done. Whereas with women, it's more like everything is important. Let's take a bit more time.
Yeah.
To,
that was so patronizing, wasn't it? Yeah. I don't agree with him, not for one moment. So I know that we're going to move on. Second topic, second sleep now.
Okay, second sleep is something that's been getting a lot more coverage on the internet and, you know, articles and stuff like that. Apparently, we as in humans, used to have segmented sleep, which sleep right after dinner or right after dusk, wake up at about midnight or 1, and interact with each other and do things for a couple of hours and 2 or 3, go back to sleep and wake up at the break of dawn. And apparently, most cultures did it. How do we know this now? Is because it was mentioned in the Odyssey, Homer's Odyssey. So it goes that far back, in Don Quixote, Dickens. Mentioned casually, not as something which was unusual. It's like, oh yeah, and so did something in their second sleep. Sounds like everybody did it. Unfortunately, we don't know whether people did it in Asia. There is information about Africa. There were tribes in Africa that did this, but we don't know whether Asians actually did. Maybe we did. I don't know. The Chinese had great records, but there's nothing in there. So it's a very interesting thing because people took it very seriously. It was very much a part of life. Like there are prayer manuals for what to do during the interim period between the two sleeps. There's a medical journal from the 16th century France where doctors actually told couples to try to conceive. They can't conceive during this period because that was when they were at their best. So it seemed that everybody found that this interim period was a good time to do things. Communities would get together and just chat. People who wrote would write. People who had some extra work to do, would do it then.
And now, are you converted to this? Is this a fad? It's like a paleo diet kind of thing.
I don't know. It's the thing is, some people have done tests. Sleep therapists or whatever have done it. And they find that people will naturally move to that. And they get better sleep that way. Individuals have actually tried doing it. And they found that that interim period between the two sleeps is a very good time for them to work, be by themselves. So I can imagine that if we go, the only reason why these people do not continue is because they find that if nobody else is doing it, basically you're sleeping too early and missing out on, you know, late night movies with your friends. And during that interim period, you're just by yourself. So if everybody did it, it could be very interesting. So I don't know. What do you guys think?
Perhaps actually even the opposite might be true, that the reason it's effective is because not everyone does it. And so you're awake at a time when everyone else is asleep, the world is quieter, your house is quieter.
Exactly. Yeah.
So it's a great time for productivity.
And you're a bit fresh because you've gotten 4 hours.
Right.
And,
so I'm thinking of people who are, you know, creatives mostly, artists, writers, for whom having just woken up from sleeping and that whole idea of having had dreams and thoughts and processed things and then straight away jumping into creating work at a time when no one else is around to bother you, I'm actually kind of thinking maybe it's good that not everybody would do it, right? Because then you have that time. Where else, if as a culture, we all woke up at 3 a.m., did 2 hours of work, eventually somebody would tell us, come into the office for that two hours and then go home and sleep.
But that's true. It's kind of impossible to do now because it started to be on a decline when light started to enter the world. When street lights became something that in most metropolitan areas made being outside safer. And also late night entertainment started happening. People had cafes that went on late and people watched the opera until late. So it started with the upper classes, but the working classes remained in that segmented sleep kind of thing. So basically it's impossible to do now because there's entertainment, there's light, there's the internet.
But for the most part of the existence of humankind, this is how people live.
I mean,
there are people even now in this world who might be listening to a bit of culture right now, probably unlikely, who don't have electricity, so I don't say how they could. And everything, what on earth are these people talking about? This is just, you go to bed when it's dark.
When it's dark, there's nothing to do.
You get up again. So we live now in a false time frame.
Yeah, apparently. They say that that's why we have a lot of people have insomnia.
Because you can't remember the word.
sleep anxiety and stuff. People wake up in the middle of the night and don't know why they are feeling so anxious.
Well, I have that. And in fact, just the other night, and it really mystified me. But actually, what you're saying is that I was actually doing what's natural, as it were. I should be waking up at midnight.
Yeah, and you should be chill about it. You should go out and make yourself a cup of tea or watch.
I shouldn't fight
read
it.
A book.
Well, but then I would assume that would only work if that first sleep was good sleep, which is also a challenge that we face, which is just not getting good sleep to begin with.
Absolutely. Because I woke up at like 2 in the morning the other day, and I couldn't get back to sleep, so I got up. It has become my routine now is to get up very, very early and to work early. And it does really work for me. Actually, what I'm doing, you're saying, is some sort of paleo sleep thing.
You're going back to your roots.
Going to my roots. Yeah. Because, I mean, crazy. Imagine we didn't have electric light. People who would be staying up till 1 in the morning, what on earth would you do?
Right. Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't be able to do much.
You couldn't do anything. Yeah.
And apparently it was very expensive. Even we don't think of it as being expensive. But one of the articles I read said that even a candle costs a lot. Even the oil in your lamps would be a costly thing for even a middle class person back then, 15th, 16th century. So you would only want to have it on for emergencies or for
well, as a sidebar to that, the 19th century, the Victorian era was the golden age of ghost stories.
Right.
People were writing ghost stories and aware of places being ghostly. And one of the theories is that at that time you had the new mass production of candles, industrial production of candles, which you'd never had before. So people were able to light candles, stay up late, but they were in enclosed spaces. So you would have a buildup of carbon monoxide in these rooms. And so people are actually hallucinating ghosts.
that makes a lot of sense.
Because people were staying up later than their grandparents had ever been. That's a new experience. So at night, and they're seeing things.
Right. Big strange sounds and shadows and everything.
Because there's no oxygen in the room.
Absolutely. No oxygen in the room helps too,
So, are you going to do it? Are you going to do it?
I'm actually going to. The hard thing is sleeping immediately after sundown. You know, because that's when, for me, that is when I start feeling a little bit up. I want to exercise or write or whatever. So I might experiment with it if I have.
Jamila, would you?
Well, you know, it struck me as you were saying, I actually do a version of this when I have deadlines. I try to go to bed by, say, 9 o'clock, and then I'll wake up at 2 when everyone else is asleep, and basically there are no cars outside. And then I write till about 6 and then go back to sleep till it's time to get up to work.
There you go. Did it work for you? Or is it?
It does. I actually write a lot better late at night. And because I realize this, I try and, you know, fit it in into a time that works for me.
So I kind of did it during the World Cup.
That's different. That's very different. That just doesn't count at all. So, okay. And we move on. And in a moment, we shall come back with Shamila's first ever topic here on A Bit of Culture.
And a word from our sponsor. You do that? You don't do that.
No. Nod, please don't point to the fact that we have no sponsors. It's just so humiliating. Here on A Bit of Culture, BFM 89.9. And we're back with myself, Cam Rustler, Naa Murad, and Shamila Gunnison.
Hello.
Hello. Now, Shamila, topic number 3, clothes and culture.
Yeah, so this was inspired by a recent experience of mine. I was in Sydney, and for the first time, I had an opportunity to do something that I wanted to do for a really long time, which is to catch an opera in the Sydney Opera House. It was Aida. And so I was very excited, and sort of as I was leaving, I decided that I would put on, you know, winged eyeliner tips, which is Egyptian inspired. I would wear earrings that looked vaguely Egyptian anyway. And I sort of texted one of my friends and said, oh, I'm all dressed up for Aida with my Egyptian earrings. And he said, do you think anyone will actually notice you did that? And I immediately replied and went, well, I'm not doing it for others. I'm doing it for myself because I want to feel like I belong. And he sort of started making fun of me a little bit. And this led me to thinking about, why do we do that? Why does dressing in something, putting something on yourself, whether it's makeup or clothes or a pin or a badge, make you feel like you're part of something? Wearing a Star Wars t-shirt when you watch Star Wars, painting your face when you go to a football game, putting on a jersey.
Wearing the color of a political rally.
Yes, yeah, exactly, in politics, you know, right?
Banner on your head.
You right, know? And what is it about that act that makes you feel like you're more invested in whatever that you're participating in? And it was quite interesting because this friend that I was talking to was a guy, and he didn't get what I was saying about, you know, I feel like I'm a little bit more part of the opera now. But then I was like, wait, hang on, you're a huge football fan, and you clearly put on your Manchester United jersey each time there's a match. And that whole idea of the 12th man, you know, the 12th player being the fan or the supporters. And so I think that it's really interesting that we're not in any way really creating that whatever we're watching. However, we are a part of the experience because without the audience, there's no show. Without the spectators, there's not going to be a football match. Mm.
Well, first of all, Shamila, I'd say you're a girl, so you don't know what you're talking about. Football's completely different. How dare you? Right?
She'll patronize. I'm not going to say anything.
I know, and he called you patronizing earlier.
I'm just setting the record straight. No, I agree entirely. And it's interesting because following on also from Naa's topic, that there's kind of this paleo, let's get back to ancient man kind of quality.
A tribal thing.
It's a tribal thing.
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things, we are communal creatures, and one of the most satisfying, exciting things we can ever do is know that we're a member of a community.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do go to a concert or a sports match or political rally, that's one of those rare occasions when you realize, hey, I'm not alone.
Mm-hmm.
There are all these other people.
Total strangers, but you become part of a tribe.
And that's right. Very exciting.
It makes you feel strong and powerful. Yeah.
But is it, I mean, there's also something else going on, right?
Like it's fun.
It's fun. No, so that's part of it. So I, in this particular instance, I'm not particularly doing it so that people in the opera house would look at me and go, oh, you're wearing something inspired by the opera. I'm doing it because it makes me feel like I'm a part of it. So how much of it is us doing something to be seen, and how much of it is just us doing something because it actually makes you feel like you're a part of something bigger than yourself?
Well, but both are they not legitimate?
I suppose when something like politics, that being part of something larger than yourself, is it very important, is it not? And that's part of what rouses people up to go out to the streets and do something that makes a change.
It kind of like is, it's not only being part of it, it's showing whoever is, like, the person who's speaking, for example, or that you are totally with them. It's not just for you, I think. It's for everybody else around you. And I think when you're watching stuff, okay, I'll tell you a story. Myself, Joe Kukathas, and Joanna Bessie went to watch, what was the horrible first prequel thing? Phantom Menace.
Oh, the first, yes. The one we don't speak of.
Yeah, we don't speak of, but we'll speak of Joe Kukathas, and you should have seen this, dressed up as Princess Amidala with all the white makeup, and I was Darth Maul with the face thing, and we had a blast.
Yep.
We went to see it. It was just, well, partly because we are in the entertainment field and you know, doing stuff like that is second nature, but you feel you're part of a celebration of something. You're celebrating this film, which turned out to be rubbish. But
it turned out to be rubbish. So when you came out of the movie theater and you'd made all this effort to dress up something that was so bad that we don't speak of it ever again. I mean, how did you feel then?
Well, you know, it's always a miscalculation. I
mean, then there's shame.
You could have gone to watch Ida, and of course, it won't be a different opera, but it could have been a bad performance, for example.
Sure.
You still support the basic meaning of what of opera.
Support Verdi.
Which I know, Cam, you're going to say you don't.
Well, because Sharmila, I think it needs to be said. Does it need to be? I'm going to say it anyway. That in the world of opera, there are two opera fans. There's Wagnerians. People love
tribes,
Wagner,
as you mentioned.
Yeah, tribes. Yeah. And then there's everyone else. When you told the story to me, I think I've been to see Wagner. I love Wagner. And How did I dress that one? You know, like, was it an issue in my mind?
Like this, the one shirt.
Well, no, I did make an effort to dress up. I did not go in like wearing a breastplate with horned helmets and carrying a spear.
But see,
with your pet dragon.
But that is interesting, isn't it? Because we don't typically think of something like opera as something that people would dress up to go and watch. Whereas Star Wars, it's very common, but perhaps for people from my generation, increasingly now, because of social media, because of the fact that we share the things that we do, even something like opera, which can be considered, you wouldn't have worn Wagner-themed cufflinks to an opera, would you?
No.
But then
no.
It doesn't seem odd
Wagner
to me.
T-shirt.
But they do sell those German things now, no? They sell opera-themed cufflinks, or even t-shirts for that matter, and merchandising. So everything is pretty much merchandising for a generation that's used to displaying their passions.
Yeah. I think people should go to museums dressed up in museum theme.
I would be into that.
Go to the Met dressed up. Like, you know.
I don't know. I mean, but there is a uniform. There is a uniform for going to the opera. So let's say, for instance, in the case of political parties, you're wearing the uniform for that political party, and it's like community and it's happiness, but then you accidentally walk into the rally for the opposing political party. Then suddenly that decision to wear that outfit suddenly feels like a very bad decision. and so you
same with football.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, yes.
So
take the wrong bus and everybody is...
Yeah, so the whole of the wearing the wardrobe of the thing is predicated on the that you must be able to get that sense of community, because the opposite is terrifying.
You don't want to be wearing a Batman t-shirt at a Marvel movie launch, perhaps.
Well, Star Trek, Star Wars.
Star Wars.
Yeah, I have spoken to Uma Paganampike-Parkin, and it gets pretty ugly, apparently, at these comic conventions.
Yeah.
That guy who got stripped of his jersey, right? Was he a Manchester fan at a Liverpool match?
Yeah, that would be a bad idea.
Yeah, they pulled his shirt off on camera.
Really? So, I mean, if you are going to go to the effort of wearing the right thing, you want to be walking into safety. That's also what you want. You want the ultimate safety. You're going to the safest place you know, Sydney Opera House, Ida.
I don't think opera fans have fistfights though. So
Wagner fans might.
Don't come at me with your Italian opera.
All right.
Oi. Yeah.
But I think, no, actually the safe space is significant, because the idea of dressing up, especially if you're going to the extent of painting your face and wearing something outlandish, you want to be assured that you're not going to be, at the very least, laughed at.
Ridiculed, yeah.
Ridiculed. Yeah, so exactly. It has to be in a space that you feel comfortable in.
See, back in the 1980s, I was a member of a tribe, which I was a neuromantic. And so, you know, people like Duran Duran, David Bowie. So I would, you know, wear makeup and wear, you know, a blouse, basically. and I wouldn't walk, I'd flounce. And I got beaten up a lot. So so
this is in KL or
in England.
Did you go to
England.
Football matches?
God,
he walked.
I absolutely would not be here today if I'd ever done that. So, no, I did not. But I wanted to be amongst my people. I wanted to advertise this thing and that I would find like-minded people out in the in natural environment.
There's always that risk because I remember dressing up. I was slightly... we would have had fist fights, maybe. I was more punk than neuromantics.
Yeah.
And it was
I'm bigger now. I'm not afraid of you.
On the way to a party, a bunch of my friends. We were all punked up. We were very Clash, Sex Pistols, whatever. And we got stopped by the police because they saw all this leather and mohawks and stuff. And actually, kind of like they knew we were very young. And I think at that time in the 80s in KL, you would have been laughed at.
Yeah.
But this policeman actually made us regret that decision by threatening to any... And we had tattoos, which were fake, of course, done with hardline pens. And he just played with our emotion by saying, you're part of a secret society then, I want you to strip, da, 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 da. He didn't actually... Do what he threatened, but yeah, there is a danger of depending on where you are. I think London is fine, but yeah. KL in the 80s, no, definitely not.
So, Sharmini, obviously you didn't have this situation when you went to Aida.
No, but because I think the Wagner fans stayed away. Otherwise, yeah. I might have been
you
in
would have done.
Yeah.
You would have done.
And she would have beaten them up, yeah. For sure.
Us Verdi fans can be quite violent, too.
I think so.
Yeah, Wagner fans are just all talk.
I think you might be onto something there. Okay, by the way, are we now, either any of us, are we members of tribes now? I mean, I was once upon a time. Are you now? Are we?
I flit in and out of them, I think.
Right, I don't think I am.
I'm just too lazy to dress other than Nuh-uh.
Yeah.
I do have, you know, Disney-themed T-shirts and some Star Wars paraphernalia I bring out once in a while. But
I try to dress when I watch a Marvel film with my godson, who's 7. We both wear our Black Panther or whatever, whichever T-shirt we have, and proudly show that we are geeks.
Right. So anyway, we move on now to the last part of the show, recommendations. We recommend something that we think might be of interest, and I'm going to go first. Several months ago, Matt Armitage came on to this show, and he recommended a book, and I finally read it. And so I really want to recommend it because it's so good. The book is called Blitzed by Norman Ohler. I think that's how you pronounce his name, Ohler. It's history, it's nonfiction, and it's about the drug use in Nazi Germany, especially with Adolf Hitler himself. And so, for instance, between the years 1943 to 1945, when he died, he was just absolutely out of his head. He was on... he was on methamphetamine, crystal meth. He was on cocaine, and he was on opiates all at the same time. All the time. He was being injected every single day. And the way that this historian... Well, he's not actually a historian. He's a novelist, which is also wonderful because he's able to write this telling details, and the pacing is fantastic. But he sort of explains how decisions and moments in history, he has been able to find documentary proof of the drugs that Hitler was on at the moment that these things happened.
The doctor kept records.
He kept records.
Being a doctor.
Well, and Nazi Germany, very big on keeping records.
Everything.
So that's really fascinating. And how the military doctrine of Blitzkrieg, which there wasn't actually one, but this lightning war where the German army were able to race across countries in days, was because the soldiers themselves were on this.
On speed.
They're on speed. No, they weren't on speed.
Well,
they
were something like.
No, they were on crystal meth, which could keep you awake for 2 or 3 days.
Right.
And in fact, the British Army then tried to respond to that.
On tea?
Well, tea doesn't work, does it? They created a thing which was more like speed. Mm. And that then became actually very popular with sort of youth movements in England afterwards. Sorry, it's a fascinating book. It's called Blitzed.
Great.
I really loved it. It's one of the best books I've read. Yeah. So that's my recommendation.
Yeah, thank you.
And Nuh-uh.
This series called The Americans, I'm sure everybody has heard of it, has just finished. It's just wrapped up. It's 6 seasons. And if you haven't watched it or you gave up halfway, I would like to recommend that series is 6 seasons about those deep cover Russian spies who were placed in America in the 80s, in the late 70s and the early 80s, and they literally became Americans. They had families, their kids didn't know they were Russians, and they did all these covert things, everything from assassinations to stealing information to creating assets. And people talk about how perfect Breaking Bad and The Sopranos is in the sense of like a complete package, a series that finishes and the ending is perfect. You look at it, everything was planned beautifully. I would like to add The Americans to that list of shows which you know is complete series and it's just brilliant and perfect. And when you look at it, it's not so much a spy thriller as it's a story about the American dream, about families, about all kinds of things. And I don't know how you can do it. Download all 6 seasons or buy the DVDs. You'll get addicted to it within 2 or 3 episodes and you'll just not stop. Great acting, great casting, and it's a bit of a nostalgia thing for me because it talks about all those moments in the end of the Cold War, or could it still be considered a Cold War? I mean, just before Gorbachev came and said, you know, glasnost and all that. That whole build up to that anticlimactic thing. It's just great. It's just a great series. Do watch it. Do try to get all 6 seasons.
So it's inspired by true events, but then complete fiction after that.
Yeah, from FBI records. From interviewing actual, what were they called? They were called immigrants or illegals. There was certain names that the FBI gave them, the CIA and FBI gave them, and a lot of them were captured and later were interviewed, or you know, just from the interrogation.
So they were captured after they had already infiltrated and lived as Americans.
Yeah, some of them were never caught. Some of them could still be in America. I was going to say here, but
it's funny. I always thought that it was just a complete work of fiction. So it's actually.
Very much based on.
And
seasons do correspond with what was going on between America and, you know, like the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty. All these periods in history become the backdrop of what was going on.
And it's funny that it should end now when the sort of the reality of it's actually coming out in the open.
Yeah.
Oh, my final question is: what's a DVD?
DVD is. I'm looking at this.
Oh well. Anyway, folks at home, Google that and tell me. I'd love to know. And so, Sharmila, what's your recommendation?
Well, my recommendation is coincidentally quite in line with your topic earlier about women and whether they're telling different stories. It's a graphic novel by a writer named Isabel Greenberg, and it's called 100 Nights of Hero, and it's actually inspired by the Arabian Nights. It's a story of two women who are secretly lovers, set in a sort of parallel, alternate kind of universe of prehistoric Earth. And the idea is that there's a secret society of storytellers made up of women who are passing on stories between each other through the generations to empower each other. And the structure of the entire graphic novel is that... So this woman is married to someone, and her husband makes a bet with his best friend that the friend couldn't get her to sleep with him. And this woman is in fact in love with another woman, and they're together. And so they come up with this plot that they will prevent the best friend from trying to seduce her into bed by telling him a story every night and stopping the story at just the point where he wants to hear more, and therefore he delays it by another night and another night and another night. And the graphic novel is structured around these stories, and as the stories progress, they become not just about the secret society of storytellers, but it also becomes about the women themselves, about the societies they live in. It's beautifully illustrated, you know, and it draws on mythology that you might be already familiar with, folk tales, but she also kind of legitimately creates her own universe within which these characters live. I can't recommend it enough. It's actually one of the best books that I've read in the last 2 or 3 years.
Is it set in a medieval, like the Thousand and One Nights? Is it? Like
it's set in a... So it's not set in our Earth. It's set in a different Earth that she has created, which seems to function in many ways like many of our medieval societies.
Right.
But medieval kind of bordering on prehistoric. So it's a little bit complicated. Yeah.
Okay. Do you read a lot of sequential art, graphic novel books?
I'm not a huge fan of the superhero tropes. So I tend to read the kinds that tend to be about other things. I'm a huge fan of things like Persepolis.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Mouse. I love this one. But I do read a lot of graphic novels.
You do?
Yeah.
And in the best evers,
this would be in the top five, easy.
And it's an ongoing series?
This one is an individual book on its own.
Right.
But she has done one other volume, which is set in the same world, but tells a different story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what's it called again?
100 Nights of Hero by Isabel Greenberg.
Okay.
Sounds great.
No, because you like graphic novels.
I think I've heard of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. We'll find a version with no pictures for you, Ken.
Yeah?
Yeah.
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 Just describe the picture with words.
Words and words and words. Yeah.
Why do you speak to me like that? That's called books. That's a good thing. Anyway, so with that we come to the end of this week's show. And it only reminds me now to thank Na'am Murad.
You're welcome, and thank you.
And Sharmila Ghanisan, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, Cam.
And I look forward to for you being on the show again.
Happy to be back.
Jolly good. And myself, Cam Raslan, and just like our Facebook page, because great things will happen.
You guys are on Twitter too, which is quite entertaining.
Are we?
Is your show on Twitter? No.
No.
In general, no. BFM is on Twitter.
Yeah. Are you just shaming us again? Like, we've got no sponsors. We're not in the 21st century. Okay. Well, thank you for that.
I like the underdog.
All right. So join us next week for another exciting episode of A Bit of Culture here on BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.